Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett, CorbettReport.com, here in the sunny climes of Western Japan, where it is already the 10th of December 2013. And today we're joined on the line by Michael Meharry of the 10th Amendment Center, 10thamendmentcenter.org. Michael, it is great to have you on the program today. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's a real pleasure to be on. It's kind of cool. You're in the morning and I'm at night, so we're like doing this 2 days at the same time.
Exactly right. I always say I'm coming to you from the future. Well, for those of the listeners out there who may not be aware of the 10th Amendment Center, why don't we talk a little bit about what it is and the work that you guys do there?
Well, sure, I'd be happy to do that. The 10th Amendment Center is a political organization. We used to call ourselves a think tank, and we are part think tank, but we're also part activist organization as well. And we're primarily focused on constitutional issues, obviously the 10th Amendment. And I can sum up kind of our mission in one word, or one sentence, I should say. Follow the Constitution, every issue, every time, no exceptions, and no excuses. That's kind of how we sum up our work. And we're primarily focused, again, on constitutional originalism and decentralization. We really want to decentralize power back to the way that the framers and the ratifiers of the Constitution intended. We feel like that liberty is better protected when you have a decentralized system of government. So that's primarily our work. And we kind of do it in two different ways. We are a think tank, so we do a lot of articles and research and things like that to educate people on constitutional issues. And then we also do a good deal of activism, which involves trying to get legislation passed at the state and local level to push back against overreaching federal power.
And for the listeners out there who may need some education of their constitutional matters, what is the 10th Amendment?
10th Amendment is what they call a rule of construction, and it actually goes together with the 9th Amendment. And they were essentially both intended to direct readers of the Constitution into how they should interpret it. And basically, the 10th Amendment says that all powers that are not delegated to the federal government or prohibited to the states by the Constitution remain with the states and the people. James Madison kind of summed up the intended structure of the United States in Federalist 45 when he said that the powers of the federal government are few and defined, and those which remain with the states and the people are numerous and indefinite. And he went on and he explained it. He said the federal government would primarily deal with things such as trade, foreign issues, war, peace, treaties with other nations, and that all of the things that have to do with the rights, liberties, and the people and the internal improvement and prosperity of the states would be left to the states. Now, obviously, we're nowhere near that anymore, but that was the intended structure. And the 10th Amendment is the rule of construction that kind of tells you that. And it essentially says if you don't find the power delegated in the Constitution, then it should be left to the states and the people themselves. And that works along with the 9th Amendment, which said that any of these rights that we are laying out in the Bill of Rights, just because we're making lists, it's not exhaustive. Anything that is a right that is not specifically delegated to the federal government to deal with, it may not. And so those two things work together, and they really explain the intended structure of our government.
Now, unfortunately, as I'm sure the listeners don't need to be told, over the past couple of centuries, the scope of what the federal government is dealing with has expanded and expanded as it encroaches more and more into the lives of everyday Americans. And now we're at the point where we have these overarching bureaucracies and these kind of out of control police state measures and all of these things that are just continuing to balloon and balloon. So the 10th Amendment, and for whatever it actually says, unfortunately, has not really hampered that growth. But the 10th Amendment Center, I understand, is back working towards clawing back some of this this overreach that has happened at the federal level, and as you say, decentralizing the system, which is something that I'm on board with, and I'm sure many of my listeners are on board with. So let's talk about some of the ways that can be done. And one of the ways that I know that you concentrate on there at the 10th Amendment Center is the idea of nullification. Perhaps you can tell us what that is and why it's such a potentially effective solution to the problems that we're dealing with.
Well, we use the word nullification in a very simple definition. It's any action or set of action that's taken by a state, and we're talking about state nullification here. Nullification actually could be done on the individual level as well. It's simply taking an action that renders an unconstitutional or unjust law void, null, or simply inoperative within a given jurisdiction. So when we talk about state nullification, we're essentially talking about the state legislature looking at an act of the federal government and saying this act violates the Constitution. It is utilizing powers that were not delegated. So we are going to take action at the state level to make it so that the federal government cannot implement this within the borders of our state. I like to use this funny little analogy to kind of help people understand, because sometimes they get lost in this whole legal idea of it. We call it wardrobe nullification. It's something that my wife and I do on a regular basis with our teenage daughters. And essentially, it's anybody that's had teenage daughters know that they like to stretch the boundaries of wardrobes sometimes, you know, the little too tight or a little too high cut or whatever. And my wife is really good at this. She'll see one of our daughters come out in something that's inappropriate and say, no, young lady, you will not be going out of the house in this. And our daughters, being rather relatively obedient children, will go change their clothes and go on about their business. So this is wardrobe nullification. It's the authority figure telling the person under its authority that you will not do a certain thing and enforcing that rule. And that's what we're looking at with state nullification. The states are really the authority in the system. The states are sovereign. They're the ones that delegated the power to the federal government. And when I say states, I don't really mean state governments. I mean the people of the states. They are sovereign political societies. They're the ones that delegated powers to the federal government in the first place. The federal government is their creature. So therefore, they have the authority to say, you know what, this is outside of the powers that I've delegated to you, and I'm going to take action to stop it.
Well, I like the idea of it going back down to the ultimately to the individual level, because I think that certainly myself as a voluntarist believe that it really is about individuals acting within the system rather than governments. So I do like that principle, and I do think that this is a potentially effective way of dealing with some of the overreach that we've seen. But come on, Michael. Nullification? That sounds vaguely racist. Only slave owners could want something like nullification, right? I kid, of course, but unfortunately, this is something that's often brought up. So how do you respond to that?
It is very often, and I'd like to go back to the point that you made. I think it's an excellent point, and you and I are on the same page when it comes to what we believe the role of government should be, and really, it's virtually nothing. We are so far from that. We have decided that we have to try to work towards getting back to that. And I think one of the ways to do that is the decentralization. So I want people to understand that it's not because we think state governments are great or that local governments are great and they're going to protect our rights and they're going to do all these wonderful things. No, that's not it at all. It's a way to decentralize the system. And I would rather have 50 smaller governments doing things than one overreaching federal government that accumulates so much power to itself. So I think that's I want people to really understand that it's about decentralizing. It's about bringing things down. But ultimately, I love, you know, we call it the Rosa Parks method. She refused to give up her seat on the bus. She said no. And that was an act of individual nullification. And really, that's the kind of courage and role model that I look at in this kind of work. So, but yeah, the whole racist thing is absurd. And obviously, my admiration for Rosa Parks is an indication of that. And this goes back to the whole Civil War era. And most people are taught in their government schools that the South was for nullification. The South was for state rights. The South was all about using these state rights to protect the institution of slavery. And if that was true, then I could understand why people had the idea that this was some kind of racist thing. But unfortunately, people that believe that have the history 180 degrees backwards. The truth of the matter is that slavery always depended on centralized power. It was always the centralized power of the United States enforcing slavery. And in truth, it was actually states asserting their sovereignty that fought back against slavery. Abolitionists were very strong advocates of state sovereignty because they recognized it as a way to break down this federal power that was preserving the slave institution. And one of the worst laws that was ever passed in the history of the United States, in my opinion, were the Fugitive Slave Acts, particularly the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. And essentially what the Fugitive Slave Act did was it allowed a white person to walk into any northern state, find a black person, and say, I own you. And they could go before a slave commissioner, and they could testify, and it was basically the word of that white guy. And the black person that was accused of being the runaway slave had no recourse, no right to even produce evidence, no right to testify in her his own defense. So it was this horrible draconian law. Northern states had a choice. They could either say, well, this is the federal government, and the Supreme Court has said that this is legitimate, so we're going to go along with it, or they could resist. And in fact, they did resist. And almost every northern state passed what were known as personal liberty laws. And they had a variety of different aspects to them or provisions in them. For instance, Michigan refused to give fugitive slave catchers use of state jails. The state of Massachusetts said that any state lawyer or state judge that served on a slave commission was subject to being impeached. As the times went on, the personal liberty acts got more and more aggressive. And in fact, by the end of the late 1850s, Vermont passed a law that essentially said, if you're a black person and you make it into our borders, you're free. And if anybody tries to take you out, we're going to charge them with kidnapping. And all of this was contrary to an 1842 Supreme Court decision. This was truly nullification played out in its finest form and in its finest hour. And people that don't believe me can go look at South Carolina's Declaration of Causes when it seceded, and it actually says and complains about northern nullification, and they use the word of the fugitive slave law. So this idea that it's racist is absurd. We're all about liberty, and we're about anything but racism. We want freedom for not only white people, but for every race and for every gender and for everybody in the United States. And the truth of the matter is, centralized federal power is not the friend of the minorities. I mean, look at how many poor black people have been locked up in the war on drugs. So this is not racial at all. And it would be offensive, but it's not, because it's gotten to the point that it's amusing.
Yes, it's pretty ironic that the people fighting for freedom are the ones that are accused of being on the side of slavery.
Right.
But, at any rate, yes. Well, that out of the way, let's talk about a very specific issue, and one that's definitely been in the news for the last several months, which is, of course, the NSA, the National Security Agency, uh-huh. and it's well, spying on everyone and pretty much everything that they do online. And this is obviously an issue of pressing importance for a lot of people out there, and a lot of people are concerned about this, but feel pretty helpless about, well, what can we possibly do about this? And on that very note, I understand that you're involved with the new campaign, Nullify the NSA. Let's talk about this campaign and what it's seeking to do.
This thing has gotten huge. I'm really, really excited about this because the mainstream media has picked up on it. And just today, we actually had the first state legislator officially say that she was going to run our Fourth Amendment Protection Act in the state of Arizona. And essentially, what we've got is we've got a coalition of folks called the Off Now Coalition. And it's not only the 10th Amendment Center, but also a number of other groups, including the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, Antiwar.com, Downsize DC, and a number of state and local groups as well. And we all came together, and we basically had that same feeling that you just mentioned. You know, what do we do about this? We get this every single day. It seems like a new revelation comes out about what the NSA is doing. And it's gotten to the point that it's almost not even surprising anymore. Like, oh, yeah, Snowden revealed this today, you know. And so we were looking at it, and quite frankly, believing that Washington, D.C. is going to do anything to stop this is pretty futile. We've got Dianne Feinstein. She's the head of the Senate Intelligence Committee. She's all for this. You know, you've got Representative King, and he's all for it, and they go along and they do their national security dog and pony show. So we don't have much faith in Congress doing anything, and we're not willing to wait on the judges. And, of course, the judges at the federal level tend to defer to federal power when it comes to national security. So we started thinking about it. It's like, okay, what can we do? How can we deal with this at another level? And we actually used James Madison's blueprint in Federalist 46. And James Madison said, when the federal government commits an unwarrantable act, or even a warrantable act that happens to be unpopular, he said that the states have some things that they can do to reel in that federal power. And one of the things that he mentioned in that blueprint was to refuse cooperation with officers of the union. So we started to think about it, and we're like, okay, how do the states cooperate with the NSA in spying on us? And as we did some research, we found out that there are numerous ways that the NSA does this. So we came up with this piece of model legislation called the Fourth Amendment Protection Act, and it basically addresses four main areas. I'm going to run through them real quick. First thing it does is it prohibits a state from providing any material support to the NSA. And by material support, I mean pretty much anything physical or tangible. The best example is Utah. We know Utah has this giant data center. We know that this data center uses a lot of water. In fact, they say that when it's fully operational, it will use about 1.7 million gallons of water every single day. Well, interestingly enough, the city of Bluffdale, Utah, supplies that water, which is a subdivision of the state of Utah. So if Utah were to pass this law, the state would have some control over the political subdivision that is under it and be able to say, you know what, either this contract is voided because it is actually supporting something that is an illegal activity, or even worst case scenario, once the contract is up, it wouldn't be renewed. So that's the first aspect of it. The second aspect would prohibit the state from using any data that's collected unconstitutionally without a warrant, without probable cause, from being used in state court. So we know that the NSA uses some of this data and they share it with local law enforcement, primarily for this war on drugs. So the state wouldn't be able to use that in a prosecuting a case unless it was gathered with a warrant and with probable cause. Third thing it does is it deals with universities. We have 166 universities in the United States that are partners with the NSA. They call them National Centers of Excellence, which I think is a great Orwellian term. And so this bill would say, if you're a state university and you have this partnership, we're going to cut your funding. We're going to encourage you to disband these partnerships. And then the final piece of the puzzle is that it deals with corporations who might do business with the NSA, say a private utility who provides electricity. The state could say, you know, the state can't go in and say, well, you can't do this, but they can say, okay, if you're going to do business with the NSA, you're not going to do business with anybody in the state or local government. You won't be able to bid contracts. So these four things together, we hope, will provide impediments and obstructions to the NSA, especially if we can get a number of states to work together and pass this bill. And maybe that will get their attention.
Well, I certainly hope so. And as you say, in places like Utah, where it's particularly strategic, one would imagine that would very much get their attention if it were to be passed. And given Utah's importance there as the home for that data center, have you made any progress with any of the state legislators there?
Actually, we have. I mentioned already that we have a legislator in Arizona who is committed to running this legislation. We have legislators in Washington State and in Utah that have both tentatively agreed to run the legislation. They've not filed it officially, so we're not announcing their names and we're not making that, you know, we're not saying it's absolutely in stone because we recognize the fragility of the political process. But we're like at the 90% level that those two states will run the legislation. And then we have several other states that we believe are going to get on board too, and we're actively at this point reaching out to legislators across the United States. And, you know, we very confidently expect at least five states to run this legislation early in the 2014 session, and expect that the momentum will build as more and more people realize that, hey, this is viable. You know, it's interesting. I've been talking to reporters, actually talked to several today, and the tenor of this is relatively friendly. You know, a lot of times when you start talking about nullification, and you know, we've dealt with this with the Second Amendment Protection Act and dealing with the Health Care Act, and you get kind of a little bit of a negative feedback from reporters. But dealing with the NSA, they're not real big on the spy machine either. So I'm really confident that the combination of positive media exposure and, most importantly, the grassroots effort that's going to be behind this, and the fact that people don't want to be spied on, they want to do something about it, I think this is going to be an effective campaign. I really do.
Well, I echo that sentiment. I think if it's going to work, it's going to have to be, I think, a grassroots type movement. And on that note, if people out there in the United States who are listening or watching this conversation are interested in this, what can they actually do to help coerce or convince their state legislators to get on board?
We've got three steps that we would love anybody here in the United States to take. The first step is go to offnow.org, offnow.org. And if you go to that website, first off, you'll find all kinds of information about the campaign, about NSA spying. You will also find our model legislation there. You can download it, send it to your state senator, send it to your state representative, say, hey, please consider sponsoring this in my state. The more people that do that, the more likelihood we have to get this introduced in multiple states. A second thing we really want people to do, and this is even easier, is simply spread the word. If you're on social media, Twitter, Facebook, whatever, just post the offnow.org link and let people know that this is going on. We want people to know that, hey, you don't have to call your congressman. You don't have to wait for Dianne Feinstein to do whatever she has to do to get out of Washington, D.C., which will probably never happen. You have some things that you can do at the grassroots level, at your state level, and we want people to know that this information. So that's an extremely important thing. And then finally, if you're part of a group, if you're part of an organization, if you're part of a grassroots effort, please pass along the off-now information and consider becoming a local partner with us. And there's some information on the website that would show you how to do that. And we would encourage people internationally as well. Check out the website and get involved. This strategy is multi-pronged. The legislation is just one part of it. And another thing that we really want to do is we want to develop ways to put pressure on the U.S. government to stop this spying. And if I lived in a foreign country, especially a friendly foreign country, quote unquote, I would be very concerned because we know that the NSA is spying on you too. I have no doubt that they're gathering all kinds of information on people in Japan and everywhere else in the world that people might see this video. So you can get involved too. You know, there are ways to make this information known, share it widely, do whatever you can do to make it known that you do not support the United States spying on the world.
So what has the response been to this campaign so far?
The response has been overwhelmingly positive. I mentioned earlier, it's a very broad-based political coalition. And so we're getting support from both the left and the right. The senator in Arizona that's running the legislation is a Republican, but we've gotten a lot of support from legislators who are on the other side of the aisle as Democrats. We've gotten a lot of interest in the coalition from people that are in the environmental movement simply because they look at the amount of resources that's being squandered. And it's interesting. I just saw a blurb today and I haven't had time to really read it and research it, but it's talking about how the city of Salt Lake City is concerned about running out of water, and Bluffdale happens to be in that same area. And you've got the NSA using 1.7 million gallons of water a day. So, you know, those type of things really get people frustrated and upset. So the response has been overwhelmingly positive. Really, the only negative responses that we've gotten are the people that say, well, it'll just, you know, it'll never work. And I just don't have time for that kind of negativity. It may not work, but it's certainly not going to work if we don't do something. And part of the beauty of this is that it is multi-state and it's multi-pronged. So if the denying water doesn't work, at least we still have the opportunity of getting some of this data out of the system and keeping them from using it to, you know, lock up poor person who happens to have a joint in his pocket or something. And we can put pressure on corporations not to do business with the NSA, and we can put pressures on universities. And another thing we want to do is actually go to the university level and get students involved. And if their school is one of these NSA Centers for Academic Excellence, we want them to protest to their administration and actually pass student government resolutions saying we don't want this on our campus. So there's a lot of things that can be done. And the neat thing about it is it's not just one thing. So, you know, if it fails in one state or it fails in one aspect, we hope that there will be other states and other aspects of it that will succeed.
Well, I certainly hope that it will succeed as well. As I say, as a voluntarist, I'm usually not for political action, but but I am for the political action of nullification. I think that that is something useful that we can be doing, putting our foot down and saying no. So I hope people will at least check into this. And once again, the 10th Amendment Center is at 10thamendmentcenter.org. This campaign specifically is at offnow.org, talking about the NSA specifically. Any other links or places you'd like to direct people to with regards to this conversation?
Yeah, actually, just a slight correction. It's 10thamendmentcenter.com, offnow.org. So 10th Amendment Center is a com and offnow is an org.
Sorry, my mistake.
Yeah, no worries. Believe me, there's been many, many worse. The only other thing I'd like to mention, I do have a book that I've written, so I have to do my shameless – I'm a capitalist myself, so I like to sell some books. It's called Our Last Hope, Rediscovering the Lost Path of Liberty. And people who are interested in this whole idea of nullification, you can pick up this book, and I actually go through the philosophical, historical, and moral case for nullification. And I get into a lot of the founding documents and actually go back into some Lockean philosophy and develop the case for nullification from the very first building blocks. And if you're interested in that book, you can pick it up at the 10th Amendment Center website in our store. It's on sale right now. You get a really good deal. If you're a Kindle reader or an audiobook person, you can also get it on Amazon.com. Just do the search for it and you'll find it. And some great additional information there. And and it's interesting. You know, I talk to a lot of volunteers. I have a lot of friends that are volunteers, and I understand the resistance to getting involved in political activism. I think this is one thing that it's worthwhile because – if nothing else, we're trying to break down the system. And I read a little, I don't know if you pronounce it Hop or Hope, H-O-P-P-E, but he talks about working at the local level, you know, ignoring D.C. completely. So we've kind of adopted a little bit of that philosophy ourselves. So this is one thing I think it is worthwhile. You know, certainly I'm not going to encourage you to go out and vote for a senator or representative up there in Washington, D.C. One of our theories at 10th Amendment Center is don't ever call the 202 area code. It's a waste of your time. But I really do think that this is a worthwhile effort. And ultimately, what we want to do is break up and decentralize this system. And if we can decentralize it more than folks who really want to get out from under the thumb of government have a much better shot.
Excellent. Well, I will link up the 10th Amendment Center website, the OffNow website, and your book in the show notes for this interview so people can find that at CorbettReport.com. And I think we'll leave it there for today, but I hope this will not be our last conversation. Michael Meharry, 10th Amendment Center, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it, and I'm happy to come on anytime. And it's kind of cool doing the whole international vibe here. So I hope you have a great day. And if you want to go ahead and just email me today's lottery numbers or tomorrow's lottery numbers, you can do that. And I'll split the winnings with you.
Okay. We'll think about that. Maybe 90-10 my side. All right. Thank you so much.
All right. Fair enough.